regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new
changed.
New government regulations, which were created to protect
the
employees.
The regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to the Federalist Society's fourth branch podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. My name is Jack Derwin, and I'm Assistant Director of RTP. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the guest speakers joining us today. To learn more about any of those speakers and their work, you can visit regproject.org to view their full bios. After opening remarks and discussion between our panelists, we'll go to audience Q&A. Please enter any questions into the Q&A or chat functions, and we'll address them as time allows. Today, we're pleased to host a conversation titled Deepfakes: What, if anything, should policymakers do? To discuss this interesting topic, today we have Josh Abbott, Bobby Chesney, Matthew Feeney, and our moderator, Catherine Ciano-Mahler. Kat, who will introduce our other speakers before we get started, is currently a product counsel at Google. Previously, Kat was senior regulatory counsel at Uber Technologies and general counsel at i360 LLC. She's also spent time at Mark Burns and Associates, the Institute for Justice, and the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And we're grateful to have her as our host today. With that, Kat, the floor is yours.
Hi, thanks so much for being with us today. Deepfakes are one of the new hot topics in technology and the use of technology. And we have some interesting experts to chat through the use and implications, and of course, the abuse of this new technology. It is a new technology, but not a new problem. And so it'll be interesting to hear sort of the discussion around what could or should be done and what we think about the good use and abuse of this new tech. To discuss today, we have Matthew Feeney, who is a director of Cato's Project on Emerging Technologies, where he works on issues concerning the intersection of new technologies and civil liberties. Before coming to Cato, Matthew worked at Reason Magazine as assistant editor of Reason.com. He has also worked at the American Conservative, the Liberal Democrats, and the Institute of Economic Affairs. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, HuffPost, The Hill, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Washington Examiner, City AM, and others. He also contributed a chapter to Libertarianism.org's Visions of Liberty. Matthew received both his BA and MA in philosophy from the University of Reading. Bobby Chesney is the James A. Baker III Chair in the Rule of Law and World Affairs at the University of Texas School of Law, where he also serves as the law school's associate dean and director of the Robert Strauss Center for International Security and Law. He is a co-founder of the site Lawfare and co-hosts the National Security Law podcast with Steve Vladek. He and co-author Danielle Citron wrote groundbreaking articles on deepfakes in 2018, helping to introduce the legal and national security communities to the topic, including Deepfakes, a Looming Challenge for Privacy, Democracy, and National Security in California Law Review, and Deepfakes and the New Disinformation War, the Coming Age of Post-Truth Geopolitics in Foreign Affairs. Finally, Josh Abbott serves as executive director of the Center for Law, Science, and Innovation at Arizona State University's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. His research interests focus on the ethical, legal, and social issues surrounding new and emerging digital technologies. He is currently collaborating on a grant project on soft law, governance of AI technologies. He also organizes ASU's annual conference on governance of emerging technologies and science, as well as the ASU Arkfield Discovery Law and Technology Conference. Prior to joining the College of Law, Josh worked as an attorney in Washington, D.C., where his practice focused on international telecom regulation and antitrust litigation. As always, the opinions expressed today will be those of the authors and the discussion panelists and not of anybody's places of employment. To start off, I'd love to hear an overview of the technology itself. And Matthew, if you would kick us off with the definition of what we're talking about when we're talking about deepfakes.
Yeah, sure. Happy to. And thank you, Kat, for moderating. And thanks to Josh and Bobby for joining me for this discussion. And thanks to everyone listening on the live podcast here. As Kat mentioned, we're here to discuss deepfake, which is a word that applies to a category of content that's developed using certain adversarial deep learning techniques. And what that means basically is that you have a set of tools that includes generators and discriminators, so detectors and counterfeiters. The technology is trying to develop material while another set of the technology is trying to detect it. And the result is very realistic looking fake media that may be familiar to some listeners. For those who haven't seen a deep fake, they are readily available on YouTube and other websites. But the result is a very realistic looking, but nonetheless fake image of someone. And it has numerous applications. Perhaps the most harmless is one of satire, for example. In recent weeks, I saw on social media, for example, someone, I believe it was on Instagram, using deepfakes to impersonate Tom Cruise. There have been numerous instances of deepfake technology being used to impersonate celebrities. But there are, of course, other concerns associated with this. While it has been used for satirical effect, it has been used to impose people's images onto pornography in which they did not appear. There are widespread concerns about the impact this could have on political interference. But there are benefits beyond just satire, of course. I don't think I need to go into a huge long catalog of all of the benefits, but safe to say it's manipulated, realistic-looking media that has positive and negative applications.
No question about it. Anytime you have as your homework to read about Sassy Justice from South Park and watch the 30 Rock technical cloning of Seinfeld episode, it's not a bad way to start off. So we've talked a little bit on preparation about sort of the pros and cons, who's driving this use, and what the various concerns and legal pushes are in terms of regulating or quashing it. Bobby, would you mind giving a brief synopsis of your research in terms of the legal responses to this technology?
Sure. And thanks, everybody, for letting me join you today. There is obviously a great deal of attention at this point. By 2021, political figures in particular can see the use cases against them, all of them. It's a bipartisan issue. Everyone can understand how this could harm them. And of course, they also appreciate the harms to individuals and institutions, the malicious use of this not inherently bad technology, as Matt points out, could be put. And so there's a great hunger in the land for something to be done. And when Danielle and I first wrote about this in 2018, after Danielle had observed the emergence of a sexually explicit deepfakes, and you know, of course, the term itself is a play on deep throat, originating from that period where there was a Reddit community that was beginning to use an early version of the technology to create pornography. And we sat down to map out the full spectrum of both benefits and harms this technology probably would be able to yield as it began to become more accessible. And then we tried to match that with an assessment of all the tools to respond to the harmful aspects and wrestled with the question of, for each of these possible interventions, you know, how likely is it to work at all vis-a-vis the malicious aspects? And what would the spillover effects be on the beneficial aspects? And as Matt said, there's pros and cons here, not just harms, as with any sort of creative technology. We broke it down into things like, you know, possible criminal law innovations, possible tort law innovations, possible regulatory interventions, educational interventions, marketplace interventions, and so on around the horn. As a result, Danielle and I have been in these conversations for many years. And one thing that always comes up is, you know, never mind trying to suppress it. We just need to educate everybody. We've got to make people understand that they can't necessarily trust what their eyes are seeing, what their ears are hearing. And that all sounds great. It also sounds like the type of need for media literacy and consumption literacy that's been true for a very long time, well before there were deep fakes. And we all know how well that's going for us. And so we need to be realistic about how far we'll ever be able to leverage systematically society's understanding of these things. But critically, and I think this was one of the key points that Danielle and I introduced back when, this idea that we called the liar's dividend, which is that if you actually succeeded in educating lots of people about the dangers here, you are perhaps chipping away at
people being misled, but at the same time, you could get a mirror image effect where people who are in fact busted on tape having said certain things or doing certain things will have a greater ability to get away with it by simply denying it. And instead of crying fake news, they could cry deep fake news. And we're beginning now to see examples around the world of exactly this phenomenon taking place. You know, but as for what are legislators trying to do about it now, they're an array of interventions, very often in the nature of piggybacking on top of existing criminal law and tort law concepts that could, even without modification, could be brought to bear on these types of technologies and their uses, because the smarter efforts tend to focus on things that already are malicious to the point of being criminalized or tortious. And, you know, there's also some IP aspects of that where you're dealing with somebody's name, image, or likeness. And these haven't really caught fire yet, in part because it's, in my opinion, and what Danielle and I wrote was, this really isn't a problem set that exists or is going to exist and grow because we just fail to realize we could criminalize it or attach civil liability to it. Even if you could do those things, the idea that you're then going to suppress the emergence of malicious uses is unrealistic. Low-tech fakery, shallow fakes, cheap fakes, whatever you want to call them, exist and are used in all sorts of criminal and tortious ways, and we haven't yet found a way to completely stop that. So deepfakes won't be different. Perhaps the bottom line then, and I'll stop here, is to say that this is a problem set that needs attention across every mechanism or tool of intervention one can come up with, but we should never view any one of them as a silver bullet.
That makes sense. Josh, can you speak a little bit to this technological advancement as whether it is different in category or kind from other areas that have been potentially falsifiable that we've seen in the past? Is this different in a way that we need to treat it or think about it differently? Or is it just the next step along a path of information that can be used and abused by every person who has access to that?
Yeah, thank you, Kat. I appreciate that question. And it's a good one. It's an important one, I think, a threshold question. Whenever we're talking about potential abuses of new technologies. And that's really to kind of look at what is it that we're actually concerned about? Is it the underlying conduct, the behavior, or what you're trying to do with the technology, or is it the technology itself? And in the vast majority of cases, and I think in most instances with the use of deepfakes as well, what we're really concerned about is the use of deepfakes as a powerful tool. And so if you can make kind of, you know, an analogy back to, you know, almost any other powerful new technology, you know, firearms, for example, you know, they're a powerful tool, more powerful than a bow and arrow. You could still harm people in ways that we find inappropriate. Of course, you know, then there are ways that harm people that are clearly intentional, and such as, you know, in wars and battles. But the point is that when more powerful tools come along, you know, how does the law respond to their use in things that we want to prevent anyway? So, for example, the use of certain kinds of weapons in the commission of crimes like assault or something. Could be an aggravating factor. And the purpose of that is not so much that it's not that it's a separate crime. It's that what we're really trying to do is prevent the assault. We're trying to prevent the harm. The fact that somebody used a firearm, or in this case, the fact that somebody used a deepfake to defame somebody or to, you know, otherwise spread some kind of malicious rumor or perpetrate some kind of fraud, really kind of goes to what is the interest of the law and society in preventing the use of these tools in those bad acts. And so it may be that we look at deep fakes as being something that is increasingly cheap and easy for non-experts to use in a way that they're able to engage in some of the, you know, criminal or otherwise bad behavior more easily and do it more effectively. And I think in the case of deepfakes, you know, what is it that makes it such a powerful tool? You know, like Bobby was saying, I mean, there, you know, there are plenty of other ways to falsify some image or video. And these things have been around for, you know, for a long, long time, for as long as there's been evidence, you can, you know, make it seem like somebody else is doing something that they didn't or saying something that they didn't say. But, I think what deepfakes reveals to us is something deeper about kind of, you know, human psychology. I'm not trying to pretend to be any kind of expert in the remotest sense on those kinds of things, but just the idea that I think everyone can kind of grasp that as people, when we see video and images, our brains are really designed or primed to kind of accept those on a certain visceral level, even an unconscious level, that we accept without kind of examining it and thinking about it and considering, okay, now what is this really saying? And it reminds me of a quote from someone who was showing optical illusions. And he says, you know, why can't we see what's actually there? And so the answer is that it's impossible to see what's actually there. So what is it that we actually see? We see what we've learned is useful to us. And so in the case of deepfakes, if they're powerful images or videos and it affects people in a strong way and they have a strong impact, it's because we've learned through experience and our brains are designed to accept it at a certain level as being real. And really that's what it's kind of about is, you know, what's real. We were talking a little bit about how, you know, for forms like this, you have to be careful about, you know, if your microphone's on, if you're muted, or you know, if you say something that you didn't intend for a broader audience and you know, facing kind of the death of privacy. But with the advent of deepfakes and similar technologies, I think it's really worth considering whether we are facing the death of objective reality as we know it, or at least any kind of agreed upon objective reality, and especially at a time when, you know, you have very strongly held competing narratives leading to, you know, political and generally social upheaval. So this is, I think, an important time, an important discussion to have about deepfakes and kind of how we want to deal with them.
Josh, thanks for setting it up that way. That's a helpful way to think about it, because we've talked a little bit about the criminal and civil, or put another way, sort of the public and private legal ways of addressing this technology. But isn't it a benefit if we have a world in which everybody begins again to bring a little personal skepticism to the table? Sometimes we see, you know, an eagerness to believe whole cloth, whatever it is that that is out there. Is it a good thing if there's a little bit of skepticism that each person now has to put on their skeptical hat when they're looking at the news or at social media? Matt, can I start with you? And it's kind of that you have some developed thoughts on this topic.
I think that whether media is created by deepfake or Photoshop or more traditional photo manipulation, I don't think that people's skepticism is universally applied to all media at all times. I think oftentimes it depends on who the creator of the media is. People are more likely to vet sources they feel are untrustworthy, whether that's for political reasons or other reasons found in personal bias. So I think it's fair to say that you want there to be some degree of skepticism in a society, but as the Australian comedian Tim Minchin once said, you don't want to be so open-minded your brain falls out. Willing to examine everything with equal scrutiny. I will just say, I think in the past, people predicted that media manipulation would lead to an insufferable degree of of skepticism. For example, with the advent of Photoshop, there was at least one article that said, well, because of this kind of photo manipulation, no one's going to believe photos of real atrocities that come from authoritarian governments. And I don't think that's borne out to be true. I think the wider concern is to something Bobby said earlier, that we suffer, unfortunately, from a lot of very partisan media. If the now very famous Billy Bush video featuring Donald Trump had emerged years later, I think it's very likely that many of Trump supporters would say this is a deep fake. I don't think the timing was quite right for the release of that video, but that's the sort of thing we should expect. So the amount of skepticism in a society, the ideal amount, it's not zero, it's not 100%. But when I don't think it's got anything to do with deep fakes, I suppose, per se, but the kind of venues where people go to be informed.
Can I jump in to expand and pile on to something Matt was just talking about and a theme that really emerges both from Josh's comments and his?
Please.
Great. So I think one of the questions we all need to wrestle with, and we've been somewhat talking about it here already, is whether there's a meaningful difference in kind as opposed to an evolution of technology. That is, are deepfakes and the products of generative adversarial learning networks, is this a revolution or an evolution? And if it's just a granular enhancement of credibility and ubiquity, then we might be able to trust in the ability that we've seen in the past to learn to live with digital manipulation and analog manipulation techniques. And maybe the same will be true here. But it's possible that it is more of an inflection point and that it is a little bit more revolutionary. And so let me make the case for it not definitely being different, but at least arguably being different to the extent where maybe it won't go so smoothly this time. And it may be a bit more nihilistic of objective reality, as Josh was putting it, which is obviously a problem we've already got a significant issue with. So here's the case. Part one is the idea that in contrast to most of the pre-existing technologies, this one, with some exceptions, is relatively capable of getting above the eyes and ears test for human ability simply to detect that something uncanny, inappropriate, something's altered, something's off. A true generative adversarial network product, not something that's maybe described colloquially as a deepfake, but isn't really the product of dueling neural networks, but something that really is practically defined by being above that threshold. So that's one piece. But of course, you could say the same thing's true for the fruits of industrial light and magic and other Hollywood outfits that have provided that sort of deeply plausible imagery and audio for a long time. And that leads to the second thing that's different. The technology that yields a deepfake is ultimately going to be scalable in a way that's dramatically different and diffusible and democratizable, you might say, in a way that's dramatically different than what's true about Hollywood special effects studios, whereas the barrier for using abilities to do this are through the roof. That's why they're Hollywood studios. This is the sort of thing that is disseminating rapidly and taking shape both as commercially viable products or perhaps viable products, free academic research, free tools made available, and increasingly deepfakes as a service, just as botnets as a service and other forms of malicious online activity as a service on the dark web becomes available for those who want to cause harm and aren't sure how to do this, but they have the idea that they could do something like this. So there's that democratization of the ability to cause harm that's associated with this as well, which means more people can play the propaganda and information warfare game. And then the third piece, and this is something that came to my mind as I thought about what Matt was saying about how we did manage to deal with Photoshop. It's true. But as Matt also points out, we are now in a social media driven information environment where it's already quite clear that there are deep pathologies having everything to do with what Josh was talking about with our cognitive biases and our inclinations. So in our original paper, Danielle and I mapped out a lot of the key cognitive bias concepts that interact so powerfully with social media to contribute to the general problem of misinformation. And what Danielle and I concluded was that, at least to some extent, deepfakes ultimately are going to be a problem of truth manipulation that is different in kind, is more meaningfully problematic by perhaps a large amount because of the confluence of those factors.
That makes sense. So is the solution then just to have this detection technology be improved? Would that solve the problem here?
Go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, no, if I could jump in and, you know, feel free to disagree with me, anyone, but unfortunately, I don't think that is a that is a solution because of the very nature of how these videos and images and sounds are created. They are, as Bobby said, kind of almost by definition, kind of outpacing the ability of detection, even by not just by people, but even by machines that are designed specifically for the purpose of detecting fake content or deepfake content. And, you know, listening to some of these other comments, I think, again, hopefully not to broaden out the conversation too much, but if in fact this is, as Bobby said, kind of an inflection point or maybe even a revolution in these technologies that really kind of challenge some of our traditional notions of what and how we should regulate these activities. I think if that is the case, then I think it's fair to say that this is potentially a challenge to notions as fundamental as ideas around free speech and you know, what the First Amendment means anymore. A model of speech that I've kind of had in my mind recently, it kind of helps me kind of tease out some of the issues around speech and the competing interests around speech, which I think we can mostly, in many cases at least, agree that the production of a deep fake video or video or audio content would be viewed as an expression of speech. I mean, not to say that it may not be also malicious or false or any kinds of things, but that's okay because free speech doctrines also have deal with those kinds of things. But they are viewed in the context of speech and how you assess them. A model that I've found useful recently is to kind of think of speech in terms of imagining somebody who has something to say. And if it's in like the olden times, something like that, they're watching their, flock of sheep. And so they get up and they shout it out and they have ultimate free speech, right? Absolutely no constraints on what they can say or do, or express. But the sheep aren't that interested. What they really want is to find an audience. And so where do you find audiences? Well, you find them in towns and gatherings. And so, you can imagine them going to a city stage or kind of a walled city and wanting to go in and going to the marketplaces, the public square, and standing up on a platform, and now you've got a crowd of people that are all engaging in commerce and expressing themselves that way. And the reason this kind of model, the simple model, helps me think about this is, first of all, who do you exclude from these kinds of spaces, right? So if we're talking about deepfakes, and we identify people who are engaging in deepfakes, is this kind of thing that we are interested in excluding from certain kinds of spaces? There's a U.S. Supreme Court in 2017 called Packingham versus North Carolina, where this is discussed about the inclusion or exclusion in the public space, especially online. But assuming it is allowed to be included because of the potential benefits of these uses of this technology, then still, if the state wants to interfere, then and we want to regulate it in some way, we have to kind of cross certain lines. This is in the context of commerce. This is in the context of communication networks, of technology platforms. All these things that are necessary for the exchange of ideas. And, if there really is some serious harm on the horizon here, where we're talking about, cognitive biases and the ability to cause harm, that the state has a valid interest in curtailing speech to prevent some of these harms, then I think we are starting to talk about a challenge to a traditional notions of speech, that we need to start thinking about it very differently than we have.
There's a lot to, oh, go ahead, Kat.
No, I was going to call you in, Matt, because I think that's a really helpful outlay of, or at least an introduction to the various types of speech protections. I think that there's major First Amendment matters when it comes to the use or regulation of this technology. There are certainly private rights of action that may or may not apply. I was going to ask you, Matthew, you spelled that out well in the paper that kicked off this this discussion, if you wouldn't mind laying some of that out.
I do think that the issue of deepfakes raises difficult First Amendment questions. I mean, you've seen some state lawmakers seeking to regulate specific uses of deepfakes. And in at least two states, there's legislation governing the use of the technology before elections. And I do think it's fair to say that if the First Amendment protects anything, it's, you know, political speech, and that includes the kind of content that we're all used to seeing around elections, content that criticizes a political opponent or perhaps even seeks to embarrass them. It's not hard to see why lawmakers are concerned about that kind of material, but the First Amendment is a pretty significant barrier there. I do think, though, that when it comes to other contexts, you've seen very narrowly tailored attempts to regulate, especially in the non-consensual pornography context. I think there you have the kind of legislation that certainly isn't without its concerns, but I think even many civil libertarians will be happy to acknowledge that, look, it's targeting a very specific case that's relatively easy to identify, and that is, I would say, you know, slightly different perhaps from the political context. When it comes to the detection, though, and the First Amendment, your query made me think about journalism, because I think that journalists are in a really unenviable position here, because they often depend on sources sending them images or video. And I don't think it's a surprise that many journalism outlets are thinking hard about deepfakes, because they don't want to be caught out reporting on fake content. Now, that could, at least in journalism, this particular industry, provide incentives for journalist outlets to err on the side of caution, especially because of the potential legal implications of publishing something that's potentially defamatory. But, you know, journalism is just one industry. There are many others where people perhaps won't be nearly as careful. And I think we all can think of examples of outlets on the left and the right that may call themselves journalism outlets, but hold themselves perhaps to different standards.
We won't be naming names today. Bobby, when it comes to the detection and how that interacts, one thought that I can't get past in thinking about the way that regulation would interact with deepfakes and with this technology is that oftentimes without sufficient detection, there would be so much confusion. For example, if on the eve of an election, if some, you know, video comes out with, you know, explosive information or claimed information using this technology, I don't know that there would be time to dig in or prosecute or address that harm. And so it seems like detection is a big part of what the approach needs to be. I know that you've looked into this a lot. Would you lay out some of your thoughts around the detection technology and around where you think the limitations may lie?
Sure. You're quite right that we all understand that the truth doesn't catch up with the lie, even if you have a really capable rapid reaction. One can document the circulation of social media posts that have manipulated imagery from the past couple of years. There are sadly lots of cheap fake examples of this that spread really, really widely. And then the similar content describing how things were modified and tweaked don't spread nearly as widely. So you're right. There's it suggests that the dream outcome would be that we could keep this stuff from getting uploaded to begin with. So that raises a technical question, but it also raises business model and market questions. It's probably good to step back and help people to think of the technical solution sets as having an ex ante set and an ex post set. Ex ante technical solutions, usually this is talked about with the phrase digital provenance or content capture provenance. There are companies like TruePic that are in the business, and academics as well, and NGOs in the business of trying to develop and disseminate and make ubiquitous technologies for photo capture, video capture, sound capture, that in various ways encrypt and watermark and authenticate and create the technical foundation for detecting when the original's been modified. In theory, and I put a big emphasis on the quotes around that, in theory, if you had that such that every camera and microphone had this hardwired into it, and every entity to which, every platform to which content then got uploaded, decided to integrate that as a filter into their system, either to stop things from being uploaded when there's variance at all, or to queue things up for closer review when a variance is detected. In theory, you could exercise a lot of control here. But of course, even if you had such technology, which is it's getting there, why would we think that the vast market, which is way beyond our smartphones, the vast market of products that contain cameras and microphones, all will incorporate this technology into their devices? Some have, and thank goodness some have, but the idea that they'd become ubiquitous to the point where it would be weird and something you could discriminate against in the market if someone had content that wasn't watermarked, if you will, in that way, it's hard to see how the market gets there on its own. So does that mean, well, maybe we need the government to push that and to try to do it? Well, I guess a government could. I think there'd be tremendous constitutional questions trying to compel the platforms all to have this sort of filtering. And again, think about how much modification we all engage in with the digital content that we capture. People, I have teenagers, it seems like half their time is spent digitally modifying the content they capture. It's not enough to show that something's changed from the original capture. There's an element of judgment. And that judgment extends not just from, is this an aesthetic modulation or is there a content modulation that's more substantive? But if so, is it problematic? Is it malicious? Is it tortious? Is it criminal? Is it satire? Is it just for fun? Is it just a TikTok? Calm down. It's Tom Cruise. No big deal. Or is it something that we should actually be alarmed about? There's a huge scalability problem with that. So this goes back to my theme that this is not a silver bullet. It will help. It'll help in certain settings more than others to have digital provenance popularized. That's something we should all be able to get behind, but we shouldn't think it can become the silver bullet. Now, what about ex post? What about detection after the fact? As I think Josh said a moment ago, it's in the nature of the GAN model, the adversarial network model, that if you have a deepfake that's generated with a particular GAN algorithm, and you've got the detector piece of that algorithm, well, that it will be pretty good at detecting it, but not if you don't. And there's all different, they're not all the same. These are a variety of different capabilities. So at the end of the day, yes, we want to popularize these things. If all our phones had TruePic or something like that on them, great. That would help a lot in a lot of settings. It'd be very useful in litigation proceedings, for example, where authentication of evidence is going to start getting trickier. But it's not going to make the larger problem go away.
That's helpful. I would love to hear, especially from Josh, on your thoughts about any privacy implications of having additional eyes in our smartphones and additional ears sort of paying attention to what's going out and what's coming in.
Yeah, thank you. The privacy concerns are so enormous. I look at privacy as kind of the other side of the coin of data security, right? Some of the tools or techniques or approaches to securing our data, to ensuring our privacy, really, really kind of overlap with a lot of these same concerns that we've been talking about already, like Bobby was talking about digital providence of things. And something, for example, that just I just recently learned about, you know, I'm probably late to the game, but I'm still trying to stretch my mind around, is something that shows the enormous value of being able to authenticate something, anything. And the example I'm thinking about is kind of the recent rise and apparently very recent rise or popularization of these things called NFTs. If you've heard of these non-fungible tokens, where people are paying, you know, millions of dollars, almost like collectors, for these digital images or short video clips. Not that that gives them any kind of intellectual property or ability to exclude others from viewing them or looking at them or using them, just you know, on a blockchain somewhere. It just verifies that, yes, you are now the owner of this piece of digital property. And I think what that shows, not to go too into that, but I think what that shows is that the ability to authenticate the digital providence of something is itself something with enormous value, and also shows how the inability to properly authenticate the source of something also can be thought of as an enormous an enormous cost or enormous risk. And so I think when we're talking about things like deepfakes, again, the problem with regulation in traditional forms is the kind of what we talk about, this pacing problem, right? Where the reality on the ground of what the technology can do and how it's being used is always going to outstrip the ability of regulators and lawmaking bodies to keep up with it in any kind of meaningful way. In fact, that when I was practicing, I mean, that's what most of my practice entails, dealing with, you know, network architectures for which that were ostensibly regulated by some code in the in the CFR, but it simply didn't make any sense anymore because it was written for several generations before generations of the technology that simply didn't apply anymore. And the underlying assumptions of those laws and regulations just were no longer valid. And so, you know, how do you apply them to what's going on right now? This is where we, the project I think you mentioned that I'm working on relating to soft law, which is not a widespread term, but essentially, you know, rules that are agreed upon but don't have the force of law. So, you know, substantive expectations that aren't directly enforceable by governments. But, you know, in the gaps or while we're waiting for governments to catch up, which if they ever can, we've got to come up with some kind of rules of the road or some kind of solution. And I think that people are opening up their minds, considering some of these alternative approaches, and the need for those, I think, is becoming more and more apparent. Especially in the context of deepfakes and the need for security and privacy in these different contexts.
I think that's a helpful overview. What about defamation law? And I know that Matt and Bobby especially have gone back and forth on this question. And I'll start with you, Matt. Is that a solution that might be one way to address the extent to which there's abuse or any civil harms around the use of this technology?
It potentially is, although it's not without its issues. I do recall that I think it was a few years ago, Senator Warner issued a white paper where he did mention Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, and I believe it was in that paper where he explored the idea of, well, if a court has found that deepfake content is defamatory, then, you know, an interactive computer service will not enjoy 230 protection for that content. That's an interesting approach. I think, like a lot of others that you see in the deepfake space, it's unfortunately narrowly tailored. I think anyone who's seeking or thinking about legislation on this needs to be aware that it has to be very narrowly tailored, because as we've discussed, it has a huge number of applications, many of which are beneficial. So I do think that there are certainly people out there thinking about deepfakes and defamation. I don't know if you need, I might be the only person on the call who doesn't have a JD, but I don't think you need to have a deepfake specific law necessarily to handle the defamation or to handle the harm caused by deepfakes there. But certainly it's an area where I think the calls for legislation or regulation are probably the strongest, just because of the kind of content we're talking about.
I'll jump in and say that, of course, I think Mena, I agree that the places where you do want there to be legal pressure are places that cause the sorts of harms that almost certainly the law already recognizes in tort liability and sometimes criminal liability. And with tort, let's include defamation, of course. And you don't need a deepfake specific intervention because those laws exist. But what you might need is enhanced resources devoted to it. Or as Josh was saying earlier, in some contexts, perhaps it's an aggravating factor that should show up in terms of how the consequences of violations are expressed. And there's sometimes a public educational value in new legislation that is actually formally superfluous on top of existing liabilities, but by singling out particular problem sets, there's some value there that the law can conventionally serve. So there is some of that. So I'll just stop there.
That is helpful. It seems like one of the ways to address how this might work would be just to give, for example, social media companies additional bandwidth for or additional sort of legal support for simply taking it upon themselves to do more editing and searching. Might that be a solution? And would Section 230 permit that?
So would Section 230 permit them what to be more?
Would there be any additional liability to those companies if they were to engage in a closer review of potential deep?
Of course, you can have a large company like Facebook saying to the public, look, we view this as a really serious issue and we have a dedicated team to tackling all this. We're on it. But we shouldn't forget, unfortunately, there will be people out there who will build social and already have built websites where people will share some of the more revolting content that we've discussed already on this podcast. You have seen, for example, in the wake of the Christchurch shooting in New Zealand, that some social media companies took a very aggressive approach to that and sought to take down anything that even looked like it. And that's certainly something that a lot of social media companies can do, given their resources, but it might be harder for smaller websites. And smaller doesn't necessarily mean less visited. So for example, a site like Reddit or Wikipedia, these are widely visited, but they don't have nearly as many lawyers and engineers as the Googles and the Facebooks of the world. Maybe perhaps they would find it a little harder. I'm not an expert on the technology here, but certainly I don't think 230 will impact any company that seeks to root out deepfake content from doing that. The worry is that I think Section 230 critics will say that the law doesn't provide, or at least removes incentives for some websites to police their platforms more diligently for this kind of stuff. And that's a whole, well, we could do a whole separate podcast just on that. But that's my thoughts on the 230 question.
Yeah, this is Bobby. I totally agree with that. 230 originates with the idea of making it clear that companies can engage in the moderation they want to, the particular concerns they had about abusive child imagery at the time, and making clear that if they want to police themselves and the content that users upload in that way, that they won't somehow become liable for or make themselves more exposed to liability for doing that. That was the original idea. In terms of what their incentives are and how we might help to leverage platforms of various kinds so that they don't unintentionally become part of this problem, which is going to exist to some extent, no matter what, you know, there is market pressure. And we should always look first to that and to see whether the market's resolving this over time. In lots of context, I think a lot of people with good reason say that a lot of the costs are externalized. They're not internalized by the company, perhaps in part because of Section 230. And so the market pressure alone isn't enough to move the needle. Although I do think that over the past, really since the 2016 election, certainly if we look at the big platforms, they've experienced a lot of political and market pressure, and there's been some movement of the needle, despite the fact that they've got liability protection under Section 230. Ultimately, what are we trying to achieve here? I think the goal should be to make sure that to a reasonable extent, that companies are doing things that are reasonable in light of, you know, it's not one size fits all, in light of their own particular resources and capacities to act when they are hosting content that is illegal under existing law, that is defamatory, that is criminal, et cetera. You know, you think about how when IP, when protected musical content, video content, how much companies like Google, YouTube, and others, they're pretty quick to swoop in and enforce IP content. We want to see some amount of the same thing happening as much as it can be, whether it's with deepfakes or cheapfakes, when someone is posting, say, a malicious sexually explicit image that they've generated to harm their ex, that sort of thing. How exactly you tailor that if you decide, yes, we're going to intervene with law to try to tweak the incentives there, clearly extremely difficult to do it. Maybe it's not even possible to do it right. I don't know, but it's a conversation worth having. So when we first read about this in 2018, Danielle and I, to be provocative, we put on the table the idea that you should lose your Section 230 immunity to the extent that you don't have some reasonable degree of process suited to whatever the nature of your organization is and your resources, to at least learn that someone on the outside is trying to tell you that there is illegal content on your site. You've got to have some amount. You can't just ignore that and bury your head in the sand. I know Matt has made a strong argument that that's a lot easier said than done, and I might even be persuaded by him. But I do think that's an important conversation to have.
That's sorry, Josh, I see you coming off mute.
Yeah, well, no, just to jump in real quick here, I think we've been kind of all been hinting at this, but I think it bears to just repeat again expressly that the importance of Section 230 to to the entire digital technological world that we live in. I mean, it's been called by others, you know, the 26 words that created the internet. You know, the ability to innovate and provide new kinds of services online under the liability protection of 230. I think it's really hard to overestimate in terms of its importance. And I think that when we start to see calls from, especially from dominant firms for greater government intervention and regulation or amendments to 230, I think that it's worth viewing those with some heightened level of skepticism. There's a, you know, like Bobby was talking about, you know, they're just the differentials in resources and the abilities of different companies, depending on their size and their market dominance, there's I think a legitimate danger of kind of freezing in place market dynamics that have evolved and should be continue to evolve to bring out more innovation and the risks of freezing things in place and giving an advantage to certain firms. In some ways, this actually reminds me of defamation law and how, again, not that I'm an expert in that particular area at all, but, you know, there are differentiated rules depending on whether the person who's been allegedly defamed is considered a public figure, with the idea that public figures have greater access to undo the harm of the defamatory content because they have access to their own channels to refute it. And so, you know, if it's a public, then you have to show actual malice in saying it was defamatory. And if it's not a public figure, and it depends, you know, you can have limited purpose public figures, or if they've inserted themselves into the controversy. You know, when we're now dealing with online and thinking about, you know, what kind of access do people have to undo the harm caused by deepfakes? In some ways, we have to really kind of rethink where those standards lie, and whether it makes sense to have kind of differentiated standards depending on the different kinds of companies and actors and players in this whole thing. So anyways, I think it's just something to keep in mind about the importance of 230 and being careful about how we approach it.
We have just about 5 minutes left. And so I'd like to use the last couple of minutes just to discuss what each person thinks will likely be the landscape here, cutting to the end of the tape or sort of fast forwarding a few years. It seems like the vast majority of the use case so far for deepfakes has been more of a civil or private harm, but obviously the potential for national security or large public harm is a one-use issue that could hurt a lot more people or affect a lot more people. So I'm curious to hear whether you think that the end result winds up being sort of a patchwork of state ways of addressing this, or if there's a federal law, or if there's no regulatory change that we anticipate coming at all. I'll start again, Matt, with you, please.
Well, I think I've been wrong with every political and legislative prediction I've made in the last few years, but with that throat clearing, I'm happy to give this a go. I think that we should expect that the states will probably take the lead. I do think that the laws that target specifically non-consensual deepfake pornography are the ones to keep an eye on, because they, I think, have probably the most support from the public and also are narrowly tailored. I expect that the deep fake laws that target election speech will not last too long once they eventually get challenged. But I think it's unlikely we'll see a comprehensive federal approach to this. I do think it will be the states that lead the way on deep fake regulation and law.
Sounds like a safe prediction, and also it's not a bad thing to be wrong on these kinds of predictions. Bobby, I'll move over to you.
I'm impressed with Matt's predictive capabilities. That sounds right to me. We're going to see, like, Laboratory of the States. We're going to see lots and lots of experiments that will, in some cases, be niche, some of which will be more sweeping. The two sweeping ones will fall by the wayside, but some of the niche ones will stand. I think we will continually see interest in it at the federal level. I agree with Matt's observation that probably the stuff that tries to regulate campaign speech, like the brass ring for many a politician, is to come up with something clever that would help prevent a final few days sabotage instance, the dropping of a deep fake that, you know, there won't be enough time to walk it back, even if you could entirely walk it back. And I think that's going to be very tricky. I don't think it's impossible to do that in a constitutional way. But I'm doubtful that anyone's going to, anything that gets enacted probably will do the trick. And so I think that over the next 4 or 5 years, particularly in response to what will be a growing array of known instances where real identifiable societal harm is inflicted by various things of this kind, you'll see people pick up the banner and wave it for a while and try to get stuff passed. But as my main takeaway has been all along, there is no silver bullet solution. There's no law to be passed that makes this problem go away and recede entirely.
Makes sense. Josh, what about you? What do you think?
Yeah, I won't make any predictions. They're always tricky, especially when they're about the future, as it's been said. But you know, I agree with what they've said generally. To the extent that societal issues and concerns are the aggregations of those at individual levels, I would just say when it comes to these issues around deepfakes, never underestimate the power of an individual's confirmation bias. The narratives that we hold in our heads and whether we give credit to images, real or faked, is so powerfully connected to our own cognitive biases that if we just keep that in mind, then I think whatever we come up with that respects, it acknowledges that reality will be better.
Thank you so much. Thanks to our panelists and thanks so much to our listeners. Really appreciate you and the Regulatory Transparency Project making this possible today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kat, and a big thank you to all of our panelists as well. I think it was a great discussion, and I wish we had more time. And thank you so much to our audience for tuning in today. You can follow us on any of the major social media platforms to keep up with our content. And we appreciate you joining us. With that, we are adjourned.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.